in the past. Action is what counted. Nowadays, we are in danger, I think, of holding people for their thoughts, whether they're expressed or unexpressed, if we can get hold of them. And it seems to me that is a tremendous enlargement and might in many ways constitute a grave danger to our traditional heritage.
But Worth, I think a little bit ago you yourself stated that the distinction between acts and words, when we're engaged in what might well be described as psychological warfare, begins to disappear. Well, now, doesn't that lack of distinction, when we apply it to the problem of security, become relevant?
I think it becomes relevant, but just because it becomes relevant doesn't mean that we have to make blanket indictments of people. It seems to me we have to know what people's minds are like, what their loyalties are. But beyond that, we must allow them some freedom to think for themselves, else all of the privilege of a free society is gone. Now, what I would like to see us do is to make some discriminating distinctions between acts and words that are dangerous to our nation and those which are either constructive or harmless. And I'm afraid that when we have such bills as the McCarran Bill, which is what you call the Internal Security Act of 1950, isn't it? We are in a position where these lines of distinctions are being blotted out.
Of course, that title is a little misleading, I'd suggest.
I didn't give it that title.
If the so-called McCarran Act actually did provide for the internal security in 1950 or at any other time, I don't suppose there'd be much objection to it. The real difficulty is that there's a serious question whether it provides for internal security in 1950 or whether it provides really for a means of repression of individuals in a fashion that's really inconsistent with the things that we're trying to protect. Now, the difficulty of talking about it arises from the fact that it does a lot of different things all under the cover of that rather high-sounding title. If the standards and the criteria which the statute sets up were capable of precise definition and precise application, we'd have something that was quite consistent with our tradition and something which could be counted upon in conjunction with the judicial processes of protecting individuals and the community simultaneously. The real trouble is those criteria don't satisfy that customary requirement of ours, so that far from having internal security in 1950, what we really have is some threats to several million individuals, not only in 1950, but in the years following 1950, so that the McCarran Act is part of the problem that at the outset we agreed was the problem.
But even before the McCarran Act, Ming, we had the Smith Act, and we had, for instance, the conviction of the 11 communists. Their appeal was denied, and they are now the decision is pending before the United States Supreme Court, as I understand it, which was argued 2 weeks ago. Now, don't you feel that the conviction of the 11 communists for what seems to me to be teaching, preaching, thinking, and propagandizing rather than overt acts that could be definitely linked up with sabotage is something that ought to concern us in connection with the civil liberties of our people?
Ming, I should think that here we need to take some account of the clear and present danger test, which has been discussed so much in connection with the communist trial. Of course, I think we need to take into consideration another point there, too. We've talked here about the large groups with which security processes have to deal today. We are not, of course, concerned simply with the freedom of individuals, but in the kind of world in which we live today, of individuals whose chief strength is through action in groups and associations. That's a point we need to remember, too. But how do you think the clear and present danger test may protect individuals at the present time?
Well, I think it's a misnomer to describe the so-called clear and present danger doctrine as a protection of freedom of speech.
Now, what is that doctrine? You lawyers have a language of your own. Explain it to me.
Well, you'll remember, Worth, that the First Amendment to the Constitution flatly prohibits Congress from passing any laws which abridge the freedom of speech. The clear and present danger doctrine is really an exception to the First Amendment, which was devised during World War I for the purpose of describing a group of cases in which it was in the opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States that it was proper for Congress to take action to interfere with the freedom of speech. So that far from the clear and present danger doctrine being a protection of freedom of speech, what it really is a rationalization for those situations in which somebody can rightly be sent to jail for something that he says.
In other words, we have freedom of speech unless we use it in the face of clear and present danger to create trouble for the community.
Well, unless a majority of the justices of the Supreme Court of the United States agree that the speech constitutes a clear and present danger to the community, is the way I'd put it.
We have, of course, met threats of treason, disloyalty, disaffection, in part by resort to the judicial process. And Ming has been emphasizing the procedural guarantees which are found in the judicial process. But we've already talked about the tremendous number of people whose loyalty and dependability must be secure, both in government and in industrial jobs. We feel a need for investigations, various kinds there. And we've had to go outside the judicial process. The sheer bulk of investigations has required resort to the administrative process and some very new techniques. Now, Ming, I'd like to ask you what in these administrative techniques you think is significant and how they differ from the judicial techniques in a criminal trial.
Well, in the first place, the mere fact that it's done by what you call an administrative group rather than by a court is not of too much significance. The administrative process is a familiar part of our government and legal institutions by 1950. What I do think is significant, however, is that in our effort to deal with both, as distinguished from individual cases with which our criminal courts are familiar, we've abandoned a good many of the procedures that have been developed over the centuries to protect the individual. I have in mind things like the confrontation of the accused by witnesses against him, his opportunity to examine the evidence against him, and probably most important, his right to cross-examine people who make accusations against him. Every time I hear a witness cross-examined, I am more and more impressed with the great strength and the great protection that that right of cross-examination affords against people making false charges or ill-founded charges, and the opportunity it provides to the hearer of determining whether or not any weight should be given to the accusations. In our loyalty investigations, we have, unfortunately, in my judgment, abandoned these safeguards that we built up over the centuries.
I think our problem, Horn, is how, in the face of the danger that our country confronts and the stress under which we are, we can protect ourselves best against our external enemies, and how at the same time we can protect our liberty. Now, I believe we have come virtually to a point through this guilt by association and general suspicion and abandonment of our traditional procedures where people are afraid to join anything that is important, to contribute to anything that's important, to talk to anybody about anything that is important, where labor unions, for instance, are purging themselves, to which there can be no end in the end. And I don't believe we can eliminate the communist menace to our free institutions by eliminating the free institutions. I think we ought to try to maintain a vigorous, vigilant, and informed public opinion. And we must not allow political mountebanks who make capital out of the danger that we face to exploit this danger by calling everyone they don't like a communist.
Well, Worth, we need to remember that as many as 30 million Americans may be involved in these programs to test and secure people's loyalty. And I'd like to make another point here. We've all agreed that dangers of sabotage and espionage must be protected against. But very often the other threat linked with external communism is said to be the overthrow of our government by force and violence. I wonder whether this is the other real danger that the American communist movement presents to the United States. When we ask what the danger is, we should try to put ourselves in Stalin's place and ask how the limited communist forces in the United States can be used to best advantage. I think that the evidence goes to show that the real purpose of communist effort in this country is to weaken morale by dividing people and making them suspicious, making loyal citizens suspicious of one another.
But, Horn, I think that we not only in this country can afford a great deal of freedom, even under stress. Indeed, I believe that in the struggle against totalitarianism, freedom is our great secret weapon, and we ought to use it. And if we surrender it, we surrender one of our most precious heritages and our precious sources of strength.
I'd certainly agree with that. I think all of us in a free community have an obligation as individuals, and this includes government officers, non-government officers, old and young alike, to judge individual ideas and to judge other people on the basis of their respective merits, and then to be willing to act on the basis of our individual judgments about ideas and people.
Thoughtful citizens must expect to face these perplexing questions as far as we can foresee. Now, we can only hope that many of our listeners will carry on this discussion.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on Freedom in an Age of Danger were William R. Ming, Jr., lawyer, Robert Horn, political scientist, and Louis Wirth, sociologist, all of the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable contains the full text of the discussion and special materials prepared by the participants to help you understand the meaning of freedom in our world today and how your rights as an individual are protected by American law. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year's subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's important program on freedom in an age of danger. Now I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable presents a special Christmas program. Be sure to hear next week's discussion. May we invite you to join the new Roundtable home study courses in Human Rights, World Politics, and Economics in the Modern World. These courses are open to all, and two of them are college credit courses. You may enroll and begin at any time. Write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Today's program originated in the Mitchell Tower Studios of the University of Chicago. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Probst and is a public service presentation of NBC. This is Bill Grisky speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.